Well, it looks like we're heading back to the future, sadly. Columbia, Missouri, evidently a suspicious fire at a Planned Parenthood clinic there in Missouri. This place is attempting to regain its ability to offer abortive care. Because, look, you know, across the state, this is one of those states where you can do it, but there's almost nowhere to find that kind of care because no one will give doctors local credentials to work in those hospitals if they do. I mean, it's really another masterful way of creating an environment where it's illegal to seek an abortion. And again, we're going back to, with all the heated rhetoric, going back to the horrible days of, I fear, more tragedy, more shootings, more bombings, just horrible stuff. And also, thanks, Utah Republicans. Back in November, voters in Utah went to the polls, said we want to expand Medicaid. The Republican legislature voted overwhelmingly, two-thirds of them, which are all Republicans, to roll back the voters' will and impose a Republican expansion of, I'm not quite sure what it is. I'll just call it the Republican plan. And you go, but what is the Republican plan? Well, the Republican plan is cover fewer people and have it cost more money. Profit over people. It'll be interesting to see because, you know, here's what bothers me. It appears that Republicans don't care about the will of the voters at all. So two questions. Is it that, you know, Utah is such, is like the reddest of the red states and they know that they're perfectly safe because they're never voting for Democrats? Or do they believe the game's rigged and they know that it's rigged for them? Well, I don't know. But it's obvious they don't give a rat's behind about the will of the people. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on how screwed up our voting is, and you know this is just idiocy. I've asked our good friend Propane Jane to come talk with us. Jane, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me back.
So, what do you think? We're making bombing abortion clinics great again.
That's terrible. It's terrible. But we knew we would end up here.
Of course, we did.
Yeah. And you have Susan Collins, who sat up there and pretended that she didn't think Kavanaugh was going to get on the court and vote to overturn Roe v. Wade little by little by little until eventually it happens. And look where we are. Supreme Court, 5-4 decision. We're lucky that Roberts took the side that he did. But we knew that this is how it was going to turn out, and we told people to vote. And we told people that if that mattered to them, that that was on the ballot, and this is where we are. It's infuriating.
But again, you know, this is one of those moments where I go back to that original question, because I look at this thing in Utah, where the voters went out to the polls and said, we want to expand Medicaid. We want to make sure that, you know, everyone has some access. And look, I've got huge problems with the Affordable Care Act, but it's still better than having absolutely nothing.
Right.
And they said, we want it. And now you've got these Republicans saying, no, sorry, you're not. No, nothing for you. You'll get what we give you, which is a much more scaled down plan that will actually cost more. And I go, you know, does no one pay attention to that?
Well, I think that they want to have their cake and eat it, too. They want some of these socialized policies. But they want to entrust the Republican Party that is dead set against those types of policies to enforce them and to implement them. And it's an oxymoron. It doesn't make any sense because as a party, their ideology is not consistent with a socialized medicine approach. It doesn't go. They want there to be some level of profit and business to healthcare in this country. And so anytime you give them the reins of power, no matter how many ways you vote for Medicaid expansion, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, because they are working from that supply-side economic standpoint, they are more focused on pumping more of a profit to the insurance companies and to the pharmaceutical companies and to the hospital industry itself than they are into putting actual dollars into the system for you to actually get care at the end of the day. And so I think much in the same way that people are seeing a lot of changes that they didn't expect in terms of their tax returns, You know, this is a time of year where people are enrolling in their health care plans. You know, they had open enrollment in October, and now, you know, January 1 has passed, and you look at your policy, and you start going to the doctor, and your copay all of a sudden is more, and your deductible is higher, and you're going, wait a minute, what is this? Well, that's what happens when the Republicans vote 55, 56 some odd times to repeal Obamacare and to weaken it as a law, then you get just this onslaught of policies that are actually not in the interest of the patient.
And, you know, and again, what it does is it solidifies that view that the Republicans keep throwing out, that government can't do anything. I mean, the first thing that I talked to some people that I work with about, you know, they said, oh, we're going to go do our taxes. And I go, well, don't be surprised if you don't get as much of a return as you're expecting, because early reports are that the returns are lower because of the tax changes. And they go, well, that's just the government and the IRS. They go, no. It's not just the government and the IRS. It's a Republican-led government. This is Trump's policy. So you can't let them off the hook for that.
Right. And at the end of the day, these people have to just accept that there is going to be a government. And either you want it to be as the Constitution outlines, by, for, and of the actual people and not the corporations, or the policies themselves are always going to favor the corporations for profit and not for the individual, we the people's benefit and the general welfare. That's just a basic thing that people need to get through their heads. And that, you know, especially on something like health care, they have fought tooth and nail for the system to be anything other than this privatized system. And they want to do the same thing to Social Security. They want to do the same thing to Medicare. They actually starve these programs. And then, like you said, they come up with the old, you know, government doesn't do anything properly routine. But again, they drain the government of the necessary resources to actually do what it's supposed to do. You know, when people kind of turn their nose up at Medicaid and Medicare as they are currently named, a lot of the reason why they do that is because they have to cut corners, right, to make there be enough money in the pool for everyone. So they aren't going to allow you to go out and have this name brand prescription when you can get a generic for half the cost or even, you know, less than that.
Right.
But people hear that and they automatically assume that you've lost something and that the quality itself has been downgraded, but that's actually not the case. And I think that's a really dangerous fallacy that we perpetuate here in America versus how they do in the rest of the industrialized world.
Yeah, but to highlight your point there, I mean, you know, and to kind of push back against that a little bit, you know, because, you know, I have health care now that is, you know, if there's the Cadillac, we've got the Mercedes or whatever's beyond the Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
It covers, you know, everything. You know, there's no, but even they say if there's a generic, if there's a comparable generic, you're getting the comparable generic. I mean, I think every insurance company does that. So, you know, flipping your nose up at what the Medicare or Medicaid gives out is kind of just idiotic. And I, you know, I have people who say, well, I like my insurance plan. Are you the one that doesn't cover anything?
Yeah, but I mean, I think that, you know, again, there's an idea in terms of the lack of transparency with just how much things cost in the healthcare system.
Yeah.
That I think it's easy for people to get caught up in this bright and shiny, I have a Cadillac policy, et cetera, et cetera, and they don't actually realize what happens when you stretch that policy to its limits, when you actually do require an extended inpatient hospital stay or a very expensive surgery, that even those plans that we say are Cadillac plans often fall short. And that we don't actually have a safety net that's available for everyone to access once they've exhausted their primary insurance benefits that they get from their employer.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I've been calling for years the end of employer-based health care, simply because once you lose your job, you lose your health care. And I'm a perfect example of that. You know, all the years I was a working Teamster, I had incredible union health care. As soon as I stopped working, that incredible union health care went away. And then I had to go buy something that you go, holy, and it was culture shock for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked about this before. I mean, when our kids were born, we have three children, it cost us $10 a piece. I mean, that's the kind of insurance we had. It was the initial $10. Here, doctor, here's $10. Everything else was covered.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I move into looking at plans, and I'm looking at these plans saying, if I have a child today, it'd be like $5,000. And I'm going, who allowed this to happen? What idiot wants this plan and is going to fight for these kind of plans? I mean, it's just, it's mind-blowing. And I look, and one of the things that I've been saying is, you know, maybe the ACA should have been the handed over to the unions. They do healthcare so much better.
Well, I mean, I think that, again, you're dealing with a society that has been propagandized to believe that there is no better system than the system we have.
Right.
So any change, no matter what you call it or no matter who you have overseeing that change, there is just a basic unwillingness on the part of most Americans to accept that, no, actually, our healthcare system ranks 37th in the world. It's probably worse than that by now.
Yeah. No, you're right.
And we're not doing it better than every other country. We're actually doing it as worst as we possibly can amongst the rest of the industrialized world.
While paying, you know, 108% more than
exactly.
The Canadians pay. And, you know, a couple hundred percent more than, you know, a lot of other countries. No, you're absolutely right. But, you know, for me, it's one of these moments where, you know, I'm fortunately now back working and I have that insurance again. And I'm thrilled that our family's protected. But I want that for everyone. That's what insurance
right.
should be. That the moment you get sick, you're not thinking about, oh, my God, how am I going to pay for this? That you worry about, hey, how am I going to get better? And to me, that's one of those things where I keep coming back to this idea of having a single-payer plan where there's just one giant insurance pool. And
right.
everybody's in it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it makes the most sense. It's not something that you have to debate in terms of, you know, where the experts have already arrived in terms of what types of systems serve the, you know, greatest good for the greatest number.
Yep.
And that is the way you do it. I mean, there just isn't really another way to reinvent the wheel in such a way that you involve all of these profit-seeking entities in the process and somehow say this is a better system. Now, certainly there are hybrid systems where everyone has sort of just a basic public single-payer health care, and then you have the option as an individual if you feel like, hey, this isn't good enough for me, I want some additional coverage that I buy in the private market that allows me to see a certain type of specialist or have some really, you know, expensive elective procedures or something, then yes, I mean, that's what this system needs to gradually move towards. But again, we haven't even established just making sure that Medicaid and Medicare and our safety net for our elderly and our young people in this country is secure. And that's just not how you operate a country if you're actually focused on winning the future or making America great again. We're doing absolutely nothing to protect our most vulnerable people in this society because we won't just provide for basic health care.
Yeah, but they don't care about right. the most vulnerable in society.
Exactly.
I know, you know, decrease the surplus population. You know, I for the life of me, I hope someone will look this up and find it for me. There was a guy running for Congress in South Carolina a couple of years ago who made the analogy of his mother. You know, mama told me you don't feed the dogs because they're just going to go and reproduce. And that was his reason that he didn't want to extend you know, food stamps to more people, you know, equating, you know, poor people to dogs because they'll just go out and reproduce. So we just let them go.
That's terrible.
I guess it's South Carolina, but I guess, that's not fair. I know some really good people in South Carolina. We've spent a lot of good time there. So that was not an unfair shot at all of the people of South Carolina, not just that one idiot. So apology already there.
Well, I mean, I think if you take another state like Kentucky, right? I mean, this is a red state. They actually went full force with Obamacare and established their own healthcare exchange. They called it Connect. It was one of the best examples around the country of someone taking that law and making it fit to their state and actually bringing in people who had been uninsured and heavily reliant on government services to get their basic needs met. And it was actually dragging down the state budget because those people weren't covered. And then after they got it into action and got it working and got people signed up and it was finally working for people, they pulled the rug right from under them.
Yeah, in comes Matt Bevin.
And so, again, you know, this is something that these actual states, these voters in these states, who, contrary to popular belief and conventional wisdom, these white working class voters who are the disproportionately more represented on the rolls of requiring government assistance, they are the ones that are going to suffer for their own votes. And again, we've tried to tell them, hey, you shouldn't do this. This is going to be bad for you in the end, but they don't listen. And ultimately, they're going to have to learn from sticking their finger on the stove.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reality of it.
I'm hoping it's the whole hand, though, so it really gets their attention.
But again, you know, I don't know what Utah is going to do. Ultimately, you know, if they don't have something in place that actually covers the people in their state, it's going to come down to a matter of their budgets going under the same way that most of the red state budgets are.
It's
That's
crazy.
The reality in the numbers.
It's crazy, but it comes back to me, though, also, you know, why would the legislature, overwhelmingly, I mean, 2/3 of the legislature vote to move away from Medicaid expansion. And it takes me back to this, you know, to my original thought of, you know, do they just not fear the electorate, or is the game rigged? And I hate framing that, because I know by continuing, you know, saying that the game's rigged, that you're basically playing into the right wing's hand. But, you know, I look at all of the voter suppression. I look at all of the voter fraud perpetrated by those on the right, you know, the ID, the purging. I mean, down in your neck of the woods in Texas, you got the insanity going on there. Back in January, they said there were 95,000 names of non-citizens on the list and that 58,000 of them actually voted. So they were sending out purge cards. Only the purge cards they sent out in at least one county had no contact information. It wasn't even on official letterhead. So people, I think, would look at it and go, oh, just garbage and throw it away.
Yeah, yeah. But this is what they get away with. And you're right, in the sense that the voters are not going to hold them accountable. The voters are happy just to have someone there who has an R behind their name. And a lot of the reason why that happens is because they're so much attached to that Republican vote in terms of their own religious beliefs, right? Their own set of family values or morals that they have attached to that Republican vote, where they're going in the booth and going, I'm only going to vote for Republicans because I'm quote-unquote pro-life. And I'm not going to vote Democrat because they're quote-unquote baby killers. And so to them, all that we're talking about in terms of Medicaid and people dying in the street because they don't have health care, et cetera, that doesn't qualify as pro-life, you know, worrying about them and trying to help those people and make sure they have health care. What's been placed as a higher level of priority is having this candidate that is a quote-unquote right-to-life candidate and is going to do everything they can to make sure that no abortions happen, et cetera, so everything else down the line becomes a moot point for them. And so when they go into that voting booth, they're continuing to send Republican after Republican after Republican to office, and there isn't any accountability. So ultimately, their representatives are really only focused on pleasing their corporate donors, the people who put money in their pockets, the people who help them run their campaigns. And what those corporate donors want is for them to vote in policy that leans towards the private sector rather than the public sector. So it's a simple, you know, math equation for them, I think, and I don't think they lose any sleep over it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just mind-blowing to me. And you know, I've said before, I vote for Democrats right now because, you know, the Republicans are, one, horrible, and two, Democrats do pursue some policies that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I voted for Barack Obama twice because, you know, he said he was going to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. But sadly, you know, Democrats have, you know, kind of, you know, walked away from labor a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at that frame, you know, and this is kind of where I understand the dynamics. When you walk away from that frame, the other side isn't any better or worse. How do you juggle that? Does that make sense on some level?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that I always have looked at it is in terms of just the basic struggle for freedom and the fight against oppression. I think there's always a certain level of subjugation that is occurring at the margins. And so when I look at the candidates and I look at the issues, like you bring up voter suppression, for example, for me, you know, maybe the, you know, economics and they're getting in the weeds and I don't necessarily understand the back and forth. But when they start talking about these issues of, you know, police brutality and voter suppression and the internment camps at the border, those are the issues that are very salient to me as a voter. And so that's how I'm making the difference with a lot of these races and a lot of these candidates. Is are you speaking to the areas of our society where we still need to do work in terms of pushing towards freedom from oppression? And again, that's not a message that's important to every voter, right? I mean, certainly people who are privileged enough to not encounter oppression in their daily lives may not even be thinking about that. But I think that when you're going to these, you know, individual states in different places, those issues are going to be salient to the voters on the ground there. And these candidates have to do as good a job as they can of piecing that message together across the country, because I do think these issues are relevant no matter where you go in this entire country.
Yes, she brought that up. Finally, I wanted to ask you about Amy Klobuchar jumped into the race yesterday for president. The field crowding up rather quickly. Any thoughts on her as a candidate?
You know, I think that she has the appeal certainly with the voters in her home state, and she certainly has won elections pretty handily in her state. But I'm curious to know how her message is going to play outside of Minnesota,
yeah,
and outside of the Rust Belt in general. I think that the kind of narrative that is coming up around her is in terms of, oh, this should really have Trump scared because, you know, this is a state that almost went for Trump, and that's where they really want to compete. And now the focus, you know, is shifting to those Rust Belt states again. But I think we always have to be mindful of, again, what's actually happening in those states on the voter suppression side and what's happening with the core Democratic constituencies that you have to get out the vote on the Democratic side. I mean, yes, it's nice to fantasize about how we're going to woo the white working class away from the Republican Party magically after, you know, all these 50 years that we haven't been able to do that. But what are these candidates actually doing to address the widespread voter suppression that we saw throughout the country on the heels of the Supreme Court dismantling the Voting Rights Act? There were very direct consequences of that decision that filtered down through all of the states in these last couple of elections, and I'd like to see the candidates speak to that. If they're not speaking to that, I'm really not very interested in them.
Yeah, I Klobuchar, you know, I don't know much about her outside of, you know, she won handily, and, you know, now I know she's a slave driver from what the rumor is, and that she makes staffers do dishes.
Oh.
That's what I know.
I didn't know they were doing dishes.
she makes them run personal errands, in fact, doing her home dishes. And I go, yeah, really? So you know, looking at that, is that sexist? Because I'm sure there are men that make their staff do personal errands. I don't know if they make them do dishes, but, you know, I just kind of threw that out there.
You know, Lawrence O'Donnell had a really, I thought, interesting comment about this, and that he was saying that a lot of the issue here resides with the fact that the reporters that they put on the beat for these candidates that are, you know, newly announcing don't really have a firm grasp of policy. And so they so readily latch on to these very asinine, you know, quips about what the person is eating and, you know, what people on their staff think about their attitude. And, you know, they literally spend months on end, and they're doing it the same way they did with Hillary's emails, right? Instead of actually talking about what policies has been, I mean, these are people who are senators, who are three-term senators in Amy Klobuchar's case, right? I mean, clearly she has co-sponsored legislation at some point. She's, you know, helped get certain legislation through the Senate. So why aren't we focusing on what her actual policy prescriptives are?
That's hard work. That's a lot of reading. You know, we don't read anymore. Could you put that in a tweet? Can we text that to each other? Can we boil that down to two pages like Herman Cain wanted? Because it seems a lot. That's a lot of analysis. It's easier to talk about dishes.
Americans are going to have to expect smarter commentary. Americans are going to have to be smarter about how they choose candidates in every race from local elections all the way to electing the president. It actually matters. People actually need to put some thought into it. People put more thought into whatever the next smartphone they're going to buy, whatever the next car they're going to buy. I mean, even, you know, whatever new clothes they're going to buy online, right? I mean, they're going website to website, but they won't actually do the work that it actually takes to dig into these people's legislative records and policy positions to figure out if they have something in store and a vision for the country that actually fits with, you know, their personal values.
Yeah, but even when someone does, I mean, I look at Elizabeth Warren. The news today is she grabbed her grandson for a photo op. She physically grabbed him and pulled him into the photo op. I'm going, really? That's a big deal? Did she backhand him for not standing there? Did she beat him with a belt? You know, if you got that, that would be a story. You know, pulling him into a picture. I don't know if that's really a story.
I mean, it's silliness. It's silliness. Also, we won't talk about the hard stuff. And again, you know, I don't have to tell you that Elizabeth Warren has tons of fiscal policy to discuss.
Yep.
But again, the people who are on the beat covering her are not knowledgeable or intelligent enough to actually meet her on that level and discuss the policy that she is putting forward.
And what do you expect for $18,000 a year? I mean, look, I mean, we're not talking about people who are making huge amounts of money, and it's about clickbaiting.
Yeah, and the higher ups, right, at the networks and, you know, at these media outlets aren't actually emphasizing that, hey, this needs to be substantive reporting. You're not going to get by in this company by putting up this BS every week. But they don't do that, right? Because they want the clickbait. They want you to actually pay attention to this reality TV saga so that you're not actually paying attention to people robbing you.
Yeah, no, we've turned politics into a sport. And I've been saying it for years. We've all got our team. We all get our favorite players, and we don't really talk about, you know, the other stuff. I mean, at least with sports, you talk about numbers. You know, you put up 30 points in the last game, and, you know, you could talk about, you know, past. We don't seem to even bother doing that. This is just about attack and destroy, and I thought it was interesting. And I don't know much about Klobuchar. I'm looking, and as I tweeted out, I'm looking forward to hearing about her vision. But the first thing that I did here, and like I said, it was, you know, she's a slave driver. She's really hard, holds morning meetings and dresses people down and, you know, all of this stuff. And it seemed to me like they were trying to make her, you know, the worst kind of man.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we have to be prepared for them to do that to not just the female candidates, but every Democratic candidate that is running for president. That is a given. They're going to try to, you know, raise this quote-unquote likability question. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what are their policies? What plan do they have in place to get out the Democratic vote and turn out as many voters as they can and to overcome as many suppression obstacles that are being put in our way? That is what we as Democratic voters, as political junkies, as whatever we want to call ourselves, if we are serious about actually winning the 2020 election, we have to be focused on the policy, and we really can't allow ourselves to get caught up in this likability question. Because, again, the Democrats are already coming into the situation as the wonks. They are always going to, you know, criticize these people for being wonky, being intelligent. You know, they used to say Barack Obama was too professorial, and they felt like they were in a college lecture. I mean, they tried to use being smart against him because they weren't as smart as he were, and they couldn't discuss these issues on the level that he was discussing them. But we are intelligent people, right?
I hope so.
We have the ability to think critically.
Hope so.
We don't need the media to tell us whether or not we like a person.
Hope not.
We have our own ears, our own eyes.
Hope so.
And we can actually do that work of digging into these people's records and finding out what they stand for.
There you go. Like I said, hope so. We will see how this plays out. And as I've always said, I want the president to be at least smarter than I am.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. I don't know about that. You're really smart. Right? I don't know. That's a high bar. At least smarter than a dump truck driver. I think that should be at least the bar. And I fear that the guy we've got there now, not so much.
Yeah, and certainly he has lowered the bar.
Yeah, which maybe, you know, hey, maybe there's hope for me after all. Maybe I can be president. There you go. Jane, I appreciate the time. It's always fun talking with you.
You too. Have a great week.
Good stuff. Our good friend Propane Jane. You want to check out more of her stuff, follow her on Twitter. Also, make sure you check out the podcast if you missed anything. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. 7 years now.